Bob, I would just take what I did as governor. I cut $5 billion in state spending when I was governor because I had to balance a budget, and I was governor during the worst recession in 70 years. But there were areas where we spent more rather than less. So the right answer isn't just to cut. There were some things I completely eliminated. There were some things I cut dramatically. There were some things I didn't touch. And then there were some areas we needed to do significant expansion of our community college and four-year colleges to train more people. And so we did the biggest expansion of the higher ed system ever when I was governor. Now, net, we were cutting, but we were putting more money into higher ed expansion, more money into mental health programs. In the aftermath of Virginia Tech, we learned that, you know, we were trying to do mental health on the cheap and not treating people, and then that was causing significant problems. So in an overall, we were cutting, but we were also, in some areas, cutting more and then reprogramming those dollars into areas. So I think the two areas where spending more is a good idea in a tough economy are education and talent, and then infrastructure.
And you would take that to the U.S. Senate at the national level?
Infrastructure spending, whether it's road, rail, airport, broadband, I call it kind of a double plus because it creates jobs in the short term, but then it raises your platform for economic success in the long term. And then education or R&D spending, it just raises the skill level. And anytime you raise the skill level, that's what you need to do to be competitive in a really tough global environment.
Regarding your expected opponent in the Senate race, former Governor George Allen, was his so-called macaca moment from his 2006 campaign, is that an issue in this race?
I really think the race is more of a what I would call a windshield race rather than a rearview mirror race. I think the voters are most interested in, okay, what are you going to do if you go to the Senate? You know, we are accountable for anything we say and do. I know I am, and George is too. And so that's something that, you know, voters understand what he said, and they're going to have their own opinions about it. But I think largely the race is going to be about three things. Who has the most persuasive plan for what we can do to get the economy more robust? Who's got the best ability to find fiscal balance in some of these budgetary issues we're dealing with? And then a third issue that is really important to Virginians is how do you fix a dysfunctional Congress where people don't know how to work together? That knowing how to work together is almost the precondition to anything else, because whatever the ideas people have, if they go into their own corners, R's in one, D's in another, then we're not going to get anything. And, you know, I was mayor of a very diverse city, Richmond, where I had to work together across all the old lines to make things happen. I was governor when I had two Republican houses. I had to work together with my Republican houses to make sure that Virginia was best managed state, best state for business, best state to raise a child. I think I know how to go into a tough environment and find ways to create common ground. Those are the issues that I think will be the big issues.
A lot of candidates say, I know how to work with other people.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of the criticism of Congress, particularly the U.S. Senate, is that there are problems with the rules and how they've been used
there
or
are.
Abused.
Yep.
What specific rules changes, if any, would you support changing?
Right. Well, I do think the rules are a problem because the Senate has a number of rules that makes it very difficult for a majority to act. We are very familiar, you know, and comfortable in the country with the notion of majority rule. Every school board operates that way. Every PTA operates that way. So you're used to it. So when you hear that the Senate can't act because they can't get 60 out of their 100 members to do something, you kind of scratch your head and say, well, where is that in the Constitution? The answer is it's not in the Constitution. So there are some challenging rules about filibuster and cloture. And without getting too much into the weeds, I will promote reforms that make the Senate more accountable. So, for example, there are rules right now that let senators anonymously place holds on appointments where an appointment can't even move forward to get a vote, and the senator who's doing it doesn't have to disclose who they are. Everything the Senate does, people should be accountable for their votes and for their actions. That's what I'm used to from being a city councilman and mayor and governor. You need to go on the record, win or lose, declare where you are, and I will promote changes that increase the transparency of senators having to disclose what their positions are.
How is your successor in the governor's mansion, Bob McDonnell, doing, in your opinion?
Well, you know, I've tried to avoid looking over his shoulder, and I think if the governor, whether the governor was a Republican or Democrat, you really shouldn't have the your predecessors looking over your shoulder. But what I will say is this. I disagree with Bob on a lot of policy issues, but we're friends. I like him. I like his family, and he feels the same about me and my family. And I think he governs in a way that, you know, again, he's true to his own convictions and policy views, which are different than mine in a number of ways. But he is a person who is always reaching out, trying to work with both sides, consistent with his own views. I appreciate that. I feel like he and I are fairly similar in temperament. We try to keep a smile on our face, you know, whether it's an easy day or a hard day or, you know, something good happening or something tough. We try to, you know, stay positive. And that's what you need to see in leaders.
One reason I asked that question is you recently criticized, maybe not specifically Governor McDonnell, but Republicans in the state government for proposing to make significant cuts
yep.
to your
mm-hmm.
signature initiative, one of your signature yep. initiatives, which was pre-K education.
Mm-hmm. I feel very seriously about that. Now, you know, to state the McDonnell administration's case, they've said, well, we reduced the budgetary amount by $80 million over 2 years. We're doing that not because we want to cut pre-K. We're doing it because we think enrollment will be lessened. A couple of things puzzle me. I know of jurisdictions where there's waiting lists for kids to get into pre-K programs. And so declining enrollment and waiting lists, I have a little bit of a hard time squaring those notions. And also, the week before that budget was announced, the federal government announced $500 million of grants to states to expand early childhood education. 35 states applied, 9 states got the grant, but Virginia didn't even apply. And so not applying for funds that you could use to expand pre-K and then reducing the budget troubles me. We'll see how it plays out in the legislative session. I know the legislators are going to want to look at that carefully. On the issue, I think the research shows very strongly that one of the best educational investments that you can make is high-quality early childhood education so that every kid, when they start kindergarten, is really ready to learn on par with their colleagues. And if you can do high-quality childhood programs at that age, then you find that achievement gaps and need for remedial programs or repeating a grade, all of those things which cost money, get dramatically reduced if you do the investment at the front end. And that's why I strongly support it.
And this is a question that addresses not so much pre-K, but K through 12 education.
Yep.
Are you a supporter of No Child Left Behind and or the Race to the Top initiatives?
I am. I'm a supporter in concept, but I want to be part of the Congress that decides what to do. So as you know, No Child Left Behind is scheduled to be reauthorized. It was, you know, it was authorized for a couple of years, but Congress has been gearing up for a debate about what to do with No Child Left Behind. I don't think they will do that this year. And so I think it will be a job of the next Congress, and I hope I'm in the Senate to do it. Here are a good thing or two about No Child Left Behind, but then problems that have to be fixed.
And problems that you would support making changes to.
Absolutely. Okay. So the problem is, first, the standards are standards that are largely minimum competence standards. We want to make sure everybody, you know, gets to minimum competence and we don't leave kids behind. Minimum competence isn't the test anymore. There are competitor nations. That's not what they're focused on. So No Child Left Behind really needs to be more about sort of excellence measures. Second, I think No Child Left Behind has been administered by the federal government in a way that has been very heavily focused on the processes and the hoops you got to jump through rather than the outcomes. And I had a battle with DOE when I was governor over they didn't like the way we administered testing protocol to some of our students. And I was said, but let me show you the outcome data, how these students do on AP exams or SATs or others. It's clearly working for them. They're better than kids in other states. But we don't like your process. Well, I want No Child Left Behind to be focused on talent and results. I mean, on success and results rather than, you know, did you do the test protocol the right way? So those would be some changes that I would propose. The other thing is it's an unfunded mandate. So this is a issue that, you know, I'm sensitive to as a former local elected official. If it's important enough to be a state policy, then the state should help localities fund it. If it's important enough to be a federal policy, then the federal government should help states and localities fund it. You know, if the feds say it's important enough to be a policy, but we don't want to fund it, well, then maybe it's not that important a policy. So we have to work in tandem with state and local leaders on No Child Left Behind to make sure it's just not a whole bunch of telling everybody else what to do, but not providing them the resources to do it.
President Obama picked you to lead the Democratic National Committee. His approval ratings in Virginia are somewhere less than 50%, I think.
Right.
How will his reelection campaign affect yours? Will you campaign with him? Will you support him, particularly if you're locked in a close race with George Allen?
Yeah, I mean, my race is close, and I think it's going to be close all the way through. But I'm a friend and supporter of the president's. I'm not going to pretend otherwise. I think he's doing a good job under very tough circumstances. You know, we've had some good job numbers today. I'm so happy that we've ended the war in Iraq. We've saved the American auto industry that was spiraling into oblivion. We're not a country with a stock market in the 7,000s. We're in the 12,000s. We're not losing 700,000 jobs a month. We're gaining jobs, these job numbers today. But we obviously have a long way to go. And there are things where I don't agree with the president on. And, you know, areas where we've discussed and that I will talk about during the campaign.
Can you mention them here?
Sure, I will. But I will always say I'm his friend and I'm his supporter. And I think he's doing a good job under tough circumstances. Economically, on this education issue, you know, my pitch is we got to be a talent society. I think the administration continues to do what other administrations have done and really undervalue career and technical education. So for a long time, this nation made vocational education kind of second class. You know, that's the lesser kind of education. Other nations didn't do that, but we did. We've got to make career and technical education every bit as important as any other kind. So the White House will often talk about we got to increase college degrees. I want to increase college degrees or the percentage of people who are getting career and technical programs right here in Harrisonburg, the Massanutten Technical Center, a fantastic community resource that I visited when I was governor as I was trying to increase career and technical education around the state. We've got to do more of that as a nation, and the administration hasn't done enough there. I also, in the foreign policy area, I take a different tack from the president on something from earlier in the year, the U.S. involvement in Libya. I supported the rationale, but I think the president should have gone to Congress and got a vote. And I'm going to be a real stickler if I'm in the Senate for presidents before they put American troops in harm's way getting Congress's approval. That's a congressional constitutional power, the power to declare war or act and grant approval before we put our troops in harm's way. If it's an emergency, we got to defend ourselves. Obviously, the president's got to act right away. Any president needs to. But in something like that, I think you ought to be coming to Congress and getting Congress's approval. And I will blame Congress on that, too. I think Congress sometimes would rather have the president do what you're going to do than we'll reserve judgment. If it works out badly, we'll criticize and say what a dope you were. And if it works out well, we'll say we agreed with it all along. But I think that is a really important role for Congress to play, and I think the president should have gone directly to Congress on it.
And this doesn't get to foreign policy, but the president has recently been making some recess appointments that have gotten some criticism.
Mm-hmm. Well, I agree with the president on doing the recess appointments for this reason. Give you an example. My cabinet secretary, was my Health and Human Services cabinet secretary, was recently nominated by the president to be the administrator of CMS, the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services. CMS is the second largest line item in the federal budget after defense. They have not had a confirmed administrator in that program since 2006. It is an outrage that the Senate, whose job description includes giving advice and consent to the president on appointments, has not been able to confirm an administrator of CMS for 6 years. So if I were president, what I would say is, I'm sending you a nomination. And you know what? This is part of your job description. And I'll give you 120 days to do what you want to do and have a hearing and vote this person up or down. But if you don't act within a reasonable period of time, then any time I can, if there's a recess, I'm going to put people in to do the American people's business. Just because you're not doing your job doesn't mean that the American people's business doesn't need to get done. So I support the notion of recess appointments in a Senate that's been broken and doesn't know how to do confirmations.
You think you'll feel the same way if a Republican wins the White House?
Absolutely.
This year?
No, I will be part. I would be part of a reform in the Senate to give prompt hearings to appointees because, again, the second largest line item in the federal budget and you're not going to confirm somebody to run that agency, people who are receiving Medicaid and Medicare are entitled to have that service done well, and the American taxpayer is entitled to have Medicaid and Medicare done well and figure out novel strategies to save costs and things like that. You can't do that if you just have a succession of temporary or interim leaders who don't know from one day to the next how long they're going to be in the job.
Governor Kaine, as you know, political observers around the country are watching this Senate race.
Yeah, it's kind of fun. The stakes are high.
What are the stakes?
Well, there's a couple of things. I mean, the most important stake is I'm passionately doing this because I want Virginia to have good leadership. I really think Virginia's been on an amazing arc. In my lifetime, we've gone from economically sluggish to economically dynamic. We've gone from what I would consider, not completely welcoming and inclusive to much more inclusive as a commonwealth. And we've gone from politically non-competitive to politically competitive. In all those areas, our economy's getting better. We're getting more politically competitive. We're getting more inclusive and welcoming. I want to make sure that arc continues. So that's the most important thing to me. I have my own vision for the future of the Commonwealth and country. My likely opponent has his, and we'll compare those visions. But the reason to do this is about Virginia. Second, we got a lot of problems at the national level. Congress's approval rating is at 9%. We can't have a functioning nation with a broken institution in one of the three branches. And so we got to fix Congress. As a governor who governed in a very challenging time of economic challenge, I think I know how to fix things, and I think that's at stake. And then finally, you've got narrow margins in the Senate that could be altered by the Virginia race. You've got Virginia as a presidential battleground. The Senate race could affect the presidential outcome. So there is a lot at stake, but I think it really starts with, as Virginians, you know, we want to be leaders. I chose as the motto for my administration, Virginia leading the way. We want to be leaders. I think the things that Virginia has done offer great lessons to solve America's challenges, and that's what's at stake in this election.
Governor Tim Kaine, it is so good to talk to you. Thanks very much for your time.
Thanks, Bob.